really part of our contribution to the Passion for Life event that I hope very much that all of you are becoming familiar with. You will see some of these little blue brochures. You'll probably be given one as you leave this evening, giving details of the main talks that are coming up in a fortnight's time on Saturday the 6th of March at Great St. Mary's at 6 and 8 in the evening, and then the Sunday just after that, Sunday the 7th of March, also at 6 and 8, but in the Cambridge Corn Exchange. So take one of these, take note of the events, and be there. Now, our subject this evening is, can we trust the Bible? Did the events that the Bible describes really happen as the Bible says that they did? That's our focus. Now, there are other important questions in the Bible that we could raise that we really haven't time for this evening. There are questions about the Bible and science. There are questions about ethical issues. What about slavery? During the American Civil War, slave owners appealing to the Bible, abolitionists also appealing to the Bible. How does that stack up? Well, these are some of the issues that we feel we're not going to deal with tonight, but they are important. I flag that up. And we have some books on the bookstall in the concourse area there that address particularly issues about science and faith, and can I point you in that direction? Our interest tonight is a little more narrow, but very, very important indeed. Is the Bible reliable in what it says, particularly about Jesus, but also in everything that led up to Jesus? I'd like to introduce our guests tonight. Peter Williams, Dr. Peter Williams, who's the warden of Tyndale House in Cambridge, and that whole institution has to do with research into the Bible. And Dr. Simon Gathercole, who teaches New Testament in the faculty here in the university. And they'll be answering your questions and my questions. I have some questions to put to Pete and Simon, which I've taken from some contemporary critics of the Bible. But I hope there'll be questions from you as well. And we'll have, in due time, two roving mics on the two aisles. And you can indicate you've got a question. If you're a little shy about asking a question, you may write it down and give it to one or other of the guys with the roving mics, and they'll be happy to express the question on your behalf. Okay? We'll be recording tonight, so you'll be able to follow up this evening. If you want to come back to some of the things that have been said, you'll be able to find that on the internet. If you want to hear your question, you can find that on the internet and play it over and over again. be alert to that. Now, I want to begin by asking our guests in turn something about their particular area of expertise. Pete, for you in regard to the Old Testament. Over breakfast yesterday, I watched part of a program on the History Channel about battles in the ancient world. And part of the program dealt with David, king of Israel, some hundreds of years before Jesus. The program maintained that David was installed as king over Judah, as a puppet king by the Philistines. He was ambitious to be king over the whole of Israel, so he led his immediate followers in a series of bloody battles where he got rid of others who thought to the contrary and became king of the whole of Israel. He also butchered all the descendants of King Saul, his predecessor, to make sure that his hold on the throne was secure. A bit different from the accounts we have in the Bible. Well, why should I believe the Bible and not the History Channel?
Thank you. That's a good question. Well, I think it sounds like a bit of a misnomer to say it's the History Channel, if that was what was on. One of the things about that is, I suppose, there aren't really any ancient sources supporting this lovely, elaborate, imaginative view of things. Obviously, people have pieced together different clues, and you can imagine how someone with enough time and wit could be able to do that. But when we actually look at the ancient sources from the time, well, firstly, I'm very glad they admit that David existed, which is good. Of
yes,
course,
yes, yes.
David, since 1991, 1993, there have been things outside the Bible showing his existence from within 100 years of his reign. So that's good. So nowadays, I suppose, the debate moves on. People aren't so much debating whether he existed, which people were maybe 20 years ago, but now perhaps the thing is to dispute the picture that the Bible has. And it's always going to go on. There's always going to be room for disputes. But what you've got to remember is with the ancient world, we don't have a massive number of sources. And in fact, what people are trying to do often is to construct scenarios without much evidence. So in terms of what we look at with the Bible and its portrait of David, I think there's a lot that really stacks up there. I mean, you could take something as, implausible. You might think of his fight with David and Goliath. Fight with Goliath. And there are a number of features about Goliath's armor that fit with what could be known about the time. Also, even Goliath's name fits with the time and place that Goliath come from. If someone were writing a story, I think hundreds of years later, they wouldn't have been able to get the right sort of shape of name and the right place. So there are things like that where I would say it stacks up. So if you were trying to make the argument that David was a puppet king, I guess you'd be having to do that on the basis of Philistine sources, but they're absent. So that would be rather brave.
So someone who's dismissive of the Old Testament as a collection of fables, mm-hmm. You would want to take issue with that quite severely.
Yes, I wouldn't. I think there's a good reason to do so. I think sometimes people dismiss the Old Testament because they say it's not confirmed by something else. But what you've got to remember is almost all of ancient history is not confirmed by something else. So if we decide we're only going to believe something about ancient Egypt, when we also find it confirmed in something outside ancient Egypt, or something like that, which is, I think, what people want to do with the Bible, then, of course, basically we're going to have to empty our museum displays and so on. So you can take that view, but think about this. Take a Cambridge example. Isaac Newton, a few hundred years ago, writes a chronology of the ancient kings. He uses some good sources, he uses some bad sources. But he gets to within 2 years of the current chronology for an Assyrian king of the 8th century BC. How does he do so? Does he do so from Greek records? No. He does it from the Bible. Now, that's before archaeology began, because archaeology begins with Napoleon, right? A couple of hundred years ago. It's before Egyptian or Babylonian or Assyrian have been deciphered. The Bible got there first. And what's more, you're thinking about Isaac Newton didn't have the manuscripts as early that we have of the Bible. So in other words, him back there trusting what he read in his Bible in medieval copies of the Old Testament actually led him to reliable information to within a couple of years about a king from nearly 2,000 years before he's around. Over 2,000 years, 2,500. So it really is quite remarkable. That's not what you expect from a fable.
Okay. Well, listen, I'm sure already this is prompting some questions. We'll park the Old Testament for the moment. Okay. And let's move to the New Testament. Simon, I read just a few weeks ago a fairly strong criticism of what C.S. Lewis had to say about Jesus. This was by a fairly leading British atheist. He took exception to C.S. Lewis saying, look at what Jesus claimed for himself, that he was the light of the world, the bread of life, the good shepherd who laid down his life for the sheep. And Lewis said, look at the life of Jesus, the kind of person he was, the kind of things that he did. How do we assess the remarkable claims that he made in the light of the humble life that he lived? And he said, but this is ridiculous. We don't have access to what Jesus said and what he is alleged to have been like, because the Gospels were written in the interests of those who wrote them, and we are very likely miles and miles away from the real Jesus. How do you respond to that?
I think one of the striking things that you find when you study the four New Testament Gospels is how close they are actually to the cultural setting of Jesus himself, and actually how close in time they are as well. So when you read the four New Testament Gospels, you see that they're coming at it very much from a setting in Judaism, and they're coming at it from, as most scholars believe, you know, between the Gospels are generally thought to have been written within a period of sort of 30 to 60 years from the life of Jesus himself, so on earth. So, I mean, in the case of the first example, you have Jesus moving around from place to place in Galilee, in places like Capernaum and Nazareth and Nain and all these other places, and speaking to other Jews and in terms that they can understand. And I think it's important as well, to this point about the time frame in which the Gospels were written as well, that if you have probably the last of the Gospels, John's Gospel, being written within 60 years of Jesus' earthly life, and the others, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, having been written before that, that's important because during that time, there are still people around who knew Jesus, who spent time with Jesus. And so, one might compare it to, for example, the distance in time between us today and the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And there are thousands of people still alive today who have adult memories of the Second World War. I see some people in the audience today, and I usually think of my granny, who's 95 and often tells me about this sort of officers that she drove around in lorries and so on. So it's not the case that we're looking at Gospels which were written, you know, long time afterwards, when people had totally lost touch with the real time of Jesus alive on earth. I think it's interesting when you compare that situation, that time frame in which the four New Testament Gospel writers were writing, with the time of the other Gospels, like the Gospel of Judas and the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Mary, which were written a good deal.
And tell us just a little bit more about these. Not everybody's read the Da Vinci Code and so on, but or maybe they have, but what are these other Gospels you're referring to? Just give us a little bit on that, Simon.
Sure. Well, I mean, in the Gospel of Thomas, for example, you have a case of a Gospel where the way to find salvation is through secret knowledge of oneself, through self-knowledge, through a kind of mysterious special knowledge, and salvation doesn't come through Jesus dying on the cross for our sins, but through unlocking the secrets, really. And some of these Gospels indeed don't even really present Jesus dying on the cross at all. So if you take the Gospel of Judas, for example, the Gospel of Judas talks about Jesus as really a purely spiritual being who's just carried about by a human body. And so in the Gospel of Judas, you don't have a loving Jesus who gave himself for our sins in the way that you do in the four New Testament Gospels. And I think, again, one of the difficulties with relying on those other Gospels outside of the New Testament is that they're not written within a time frame when eyewitnesses are still around.
What is the dating of these other Gospels?
Well, around about the middle of the second century, around AD 150. So a couple of generations later than the last of our New Testament Gospels.
So you would dispute the assertions of those who say that it was a sort of KGB arm of the church that was going around suppressing this kind of material because of the nasty things it said about Jesus on the basis of the time frame, essentially?
Sure. I mean, I think there are two reasons for questioning it. But first of all, because it's clear to me, at least, that the four New Testament Gospels were the earliest and are the ones which anchored in history and in the history from the time of Jesus. I think the other problem with that sort of conspiracy theory view is that there couldn't possibly have been any KGB arm of the church, you know, a kind of secret police which went out and suppressed it. I mean, for the first 2 centuries, for the first 3 centuries, and until the early 4th century, the church had no political power. The church was looked down on by the Roman Empire. There was no possibility of political suppression in the way that sometimes we imagine.
I think we're off and running. How about some questions from you guys? Robin and Dave, would you indicate if you like a question, please? Is this not quite right? Sir, it would have been easier if Simon had my mic, and it's more important that he's heard than I am, I think.
Peace, would you like to...
Simon mentioned that reason for trusting the New Testament is in fact that that they were written so close to the events themselves. Well, I have a question for Peter. What about some Old Testament books that are, let's say, 1 and 2 Chronicles that are said to be post-exilic, which is places them in the, I think, 5th century? Which is far after the events themselves. Can you still argue that they're historically reliable?
Thank you very much. That's a good question. What I'd say with that is really what you need to be able to write good history is either that you're writing close to the time and therefore you are a close source, or you have close sources. So it's possible for a modern historian to write a good history of 2,000 years ago if they've got very ancient sources. Now, I think everyone agrees that Chronicles has some sources that go back before Chronicles. There are some debates as to what they are. Some people think it's in some part the books of 1 and 2 Kings. Now, what I think is the case is that actually there are court records which can be used. So, for instance, what we find is there's a bias in the way people write history nowadays, I find, in that people prefer, if they're an archaeologist, to find some tablet which is nice and solid and says, you know, something about what someone did out in Babylon or Assyria. And when they see Bible-written scripture on leather or whatever it is, they say, well, that comes from a lot later. To me, that's a bit like saying that, you know, paper is superior to electronic media. We normally today think of electronic media as generally being better than paper in terms of the speed at which we get access to information. However, if a hard disk stores data for 10 years, you're doing well, whereas a printed sheet of paper, you know, may last 1,000 years. Now, you've got exactly the same technological thing going on with the Old Testament vis-a-vis other cultures. Namely, it seems that in the Old Testament, what they're doing is they're using more advanced technology for writing than the other cultures. The Babylonians are scratching onto wet clay, baking it, and they've got, you know, 600 signs plus. It's very awkward. The Hebrews, it seems, from fibers that they have on the back of clay seal impressions, are using things like papyrus, perishable material. The problem about perishable material is, of course, it perishes, just like our modern disk drives. So one of the things is the fact that they have this wonderful alphabet, which is pretty close to the one we use and, you know, has been passed on from those sort of cultures nearby to us. They're using a form of culture which basically spreads things on through copying. And what we've got in the Bible is, I think, that transmission of information through copying over many generations. And I think that's far superior to what you would have in ancient Egypt, where, okay, people are writing on papyrus, they're also writing on stone, mainly decorative, and in ancient Babylon. But the problem is, it actually allows people to say nowadays, oh, those cultures have got more to show for themselves, because you don't seem to have the same amount of ancient monuments from Israel. But I think that's simply a, you know, part of the technological happenstance, and it discriminates against them because they were more advanced. So what I'd say with something like Chronicles is I think there's good reason for thinking that they had information going back, and that just as people out in Babylon would keep court chronicles, but they would be on clay in Israel, and they would have kept them in written form, written on scrolls, and so on. Now, are there any things we could do to back that up? Yes, there are. Because one of the things that you can say is, well, is there anything to support particular assertions that you have in terms of names of kings and profiles of people? And, of course, what we find with both Kings and Chronicles is a large amount of confirmation of the existence of specific individuals. So we have at least 12 Old Testament kings mentioned out in Mesopotamian records. We've got seal impressions of a significant number. In addition to that, there's also the things that they don't say which they might have said wrongly. So, for instance, if they were talking about things happening at Samaria before Samaria existed, that would be a rather embarrassing sort of thing. And so there are those sorts of tests. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, I can prove it to be true or anything like that. I don't think it's in that category. What I think it is it's a testimony. Each of these things is a testimony. And the thing about a testimony is it's actually irreducible. You can't get behind it. You know, there are some things that we accept on the witness of a single testimony because that's all there is. And that doesn't make it particularly, you know, in itself suspicious. And so what you will come to inevitably with the Old Testament is a point in which you say, well, there isn't any testimony except for this itself. Now, it doesn't mean there aren't tests you can apply, but that's, yeah, a long-winded answer.
Okay. Questions here, Rob?
Hi, I have two questions relating to interpretation. The first being more related to the Old Testament. It seems like there are a lot of things that would be very hard to believe. So I guess my question is, how true is the Bible? Sort of rephrasing the question. But so, you know, when in Genesis, people are sort of depicted as being 150 years old or 200 years old. And this relates to what Simon was saying, you know, if you have a grandmother who tells a story in the past, it seems like there might be some historical, maybe exaggeration or, you know, changing of the story. So, in terms of Old Testament and even New Testament for that matter with miracles, how reliable is the Bible for the actual veracity of those, events? And my second question, being a theology student myself, this difficulty of differing interpretations, where it seems like, you know, in the scholarly world, people have been arguing for so long over, you know, how to interpret certain passages and what certain words mean. So how, I mean, maybe this is kind of a really difficult question, but how do we know which is a right interpretation or, reliable interpretation that we can that endures over time.
Peter, would you want to go at some of the Old Testament material first, then we'll come to Simon? Is that okay?
Sure. If I just say something about difference of interpretation, I mean, there are differences of interpretation about whether Saddam Hussein had WMD and so on. There are always those sort of things that people debate about, and sometimes because there are particular agendas that people debate. So I think, to me, the fact that something's debated doesn't, you know, give me a particularly strong indication as to whether it's knowable or not. I think there are other factors that play in. On the subject of the historicity of the Old Testament, there are two ways we could look at this. I suppose from within side Christianity, if you've accepted Jesus and his authority, are there reasons why within that, if you've accepted certain Christian beliefs, you might be led to take on other ones. That would be one way we could go. I'm not going to go there tonight. I think with things like the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, those sort of things, who some of whom are said to live longer times, you've got with them some credible things about the narrative. For instance, the stories that people are moving from Mesopotamia towards Israel, and that is set in the sort of early second millennium, let's say. That's credible for that time. If someone were writing that 1,000 or 1,500 years later, it would be surprising for them to describe things like that, because the world they knew wasn't really like that. The great power was there in Mesopotamia, and every now and then the Mesopotamian kings came and raided you, and and so on. So it's a strange sort of narrative to write, but actually it does fit with what seems to be people migrations of the time. The names that people have, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, fit with the name patterns people had at the time. For instance, the first five books of the Bible don't have a single name ending I-A-H in English, like many Hebrew names later, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and so on. Very, very common way of naming people. And yet, some people want to say that four different authors wrote these books and two different editors put them together, and yet none of them chose to use any of the names that were current at the time those editors wrote. At the same time, the names Isaac, Joseph, Jacob fit exactly with a sort of Hebrew tense, which is an imperfect tense, which is a sort of name that people were using in cultures of the time. A bit technical there. So there are some credible things about the narrative. So can one prove some of the other details, say, about ages? No, I don't think you can. What you'd need to do with that is to come to a consistent and reasoned belief. For me, there's a lot credible about the narrative, and that obviously influences the way I take other things.
Simon?
Yeah, I think on the New Testament side, in terms of things like miracles, miracles are, by their very nature, a difficult question. I mean, you're never going to be able to persuade someone whose whole mindset is completely excludes miracles. You're never going to be able to persuade someone that this or that miracle, did really exist. Yeah, did really take place. I suppose what I would say though about the miracles is that it's not merely the New Testament which presents Jesus as a miracle worker. It seems to be that there's also a concurrent Jewish tradition that is quite pervasive in antiquity that saw Jesus as a miracle worker too. Of course, the Jewish tradition in antiquity that saw Jesus as a miracle worker saw him as a sorcerer who, as is reflected in the Gospels, who performed these miracles by the power of through sorcery, through the power of Satan. And that view, as I say, is not only reflected in the New Testament itself, but you can find it as well in the second century, where we have a record of a Platonist, a Greek philosopher called Celsus, who has a Jewish informant, and this Jewish informant tells Celsus, who's writing around AD 170, something like that, tells Celsus that this Jesus is a sorcerer who shouldn't be trusted because he did all these miracles through evil forces. So that I think might be helpful for some people to see that in the case of the New Testament miracles, we're not actually merely relying on the New Testament at that point.
Yeah, just a couple more things. In terms of Jesus and miracles, they really come very thick and fast in the New Testament Gospels. And there's such a clustering of miracles around his character. There isn't anything parallel that we know for another Jewish rabbi. So that's one striking thing. And it seems that, I'd say it's a consensus among scholarship, that Jesus was believed to have been a miracle worker. So whether or not he did, people at the time believed he did, and scholars now believe that people at the time believed he did. So then the question is, well, how do you explain that? How do you explain this sort of cluster of things coming together with Jesus? And of course there are naturalistic explanations for every single one. However, I suppose what I feel is that you get a bit tired about having to give an alternative account for how a miracle story can grow quite quickly up within a community that's suffering for its faith, in a context where the Christian faith seems to be spreading very quickly, and it matters what people believe. How does that spread up? And then you've got just some amazing coincidences to do with the life of Jesus. I mean, you know, most people think he died, you know, at Passover time, more or less. Well, that's a jolly convenient time to die to fit together with some of the symbolism of the Old Testament and sacrifice and so on. You know, there's just these sort of coincidences that come together about the life of Jesus. And every single one you can explain away on its own, but taken together, is it convincing? I suppose that's what I'd say.
There's another question over here, Robert.
With regard to books like Revelations, how literally do scholars take them? How far are they credible?
Thank you for that. just shuffle uneasily in my chair for a bit. I think through the history of the church, and not just in modern scholarship, there has been a long tradition of some people taking Revelation literally and some people taking large chunks of the book of Revelation as symbolic. And that debate really goes back quite early on. And I think it's a debate which comes up really as soon as people have lost touch with the Old Testament and early Jewish tradition of the same kind of literature. I mean, to us, in some ways, Revelation seems like a very strange book, but there are actually probably a dozen parallel sorts of books. You know, in what is called the literary style of apocalypse, and so I mean, my own view is that Revelation is, to a large extent, symbolic. So when it talks about a thousand-year reign of Christ, it's not intended to refer to 1,000 literal years. So I think when we look at a book like Daniel in the Old Testament, that also gives a clue as to how Revelation should be interpreted and helps us to discern which bits of Revelation are symbolic, such as the 1,000 years, and which bits of Revelation aren't symbolic, such as Jesus being Lord of all.
Yeah. Just the third verse of the book of Revelation was, I find, encouraging. Blessed is the one who reads out aloud the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it. So it doesn't say about understand.
It's like sermons, really.
Thank you. The title of this evening is Can We Trust the Bible? And from what you're saying, the answer would seem to be you can't really trust it. You seem to be saying, and I would agree from the information I have, that the documentary evidence for the Bible is pretty thin. If I can read from the pamphlet I had from St. Andrews, that the earliest complete documentation of the gospel is at least 150 to 200 years after the original. So how can we really be sure what there was written there bears, you know, witness to, you know, what was said or done, the supernatural events, etc., etc.? And then you talk about miracles, and you said you can't really prove the miracles. So really, you know, what is the point of it all? You know, I have to be honest, from my point of view, whether the Bible is true or not is pretty inconsequential. That's not the important question for me. So, you know, you seem to be answering the question yourself. You can't trust the Bible.
If you think it's an inconsequential question, I suppose we're distinguishing between, can you prove the Bible to be true from external sources, and can you? Or can you trust them? I mean, I trust my wife every day when she tells me what she's been doing, even though I can't possibly sort of prove everything that she's done. And I mean, just on the sort of individual point of the gospel manuscripts coming, the complete gospel manuscripts coming 150 or 200 years after they're composed. If that's roughly true, it may not be until then that we have a complete copy of the four Gospels together, but we do have a great many fragments of the Gospels that go well before that, within 30 or 40 years of one of the Gospels being written. We've got a fragment of it from Egypt. So I suppose I'd question the sort of point of detail as to the reliability of the manuscript tradition. But I think in terms of whether the Bible is provable, I think in one way, sort of, you know, two sort of scholars like us are not necessarily the best people to say you can prove the Bible. The best people who can testify to the sort of provability of the Bible are actually Christians who have lived for a long time and trusted it. So those are two different kinds of things: being able to prove the Bible, and being able to accept the testimony of it.
Yeah. I think one clarification is this word "proof," which is used in different ways by different people. And Tim Keller's book, "The Reason for God," is a very good explanation on that. I'd say when we say you know, you can't prove something, I mean I can't prove the Bible, like I can't prove that I exist, and I really don't believe I can. I think there are two things that you can prove in the strongest sense, and they're both to do with games. One is mathematics and one is formal logic. Now, one of the things we know about mathematical proofs, it is not about the real world, it's about the system of maths. If you accept certain conventions and certain rules, certain things fall out. Same with formal logic. If you accept certain things follow. But none of those are really about the real world. If someone wants to say, I believe we were all created 5 seconds ago with our memories, you can't disprove. You can't, you know, go against that. You can say they're being irrational. So what I'd say is I think there are lots of grounds for believing Christianity, for believing the Bible. There are lots of reasons which I think are good and valid reasons. That's different from the sort of mathematical or philosophical proof. That's one thing. On the question of the documentation we have for the Bible, firstly, we have to remember that all sorts of classical works, like Caesar's Gallic Wars, you've got 1,000 years between the time he writes and the earliest manuscript, and people aren't particularly sceptical about that. So you always have to ask yourself, if I'm being sceptical, why am I being sceptical? Then, of course, we could say, well, a few hundred years ago, the manuscripts for the New Testament were hundreds of years from after the events. Actually, now they're to within 100 years, and the gap is narrowing all the time. So you can go to Oxford, sorry, it's in Oxford, and you can get bits of Matthew or John from the middle of the second century. Now, notice, those have come from Egypt, from southern Egypt, where it doesn't rain and therefore things get preserved. Now, the striking thing is that the Gospels have been written in all sorts of different areas and have made their way through being spread very fast over a wide area. Now, in order to get a corruption of the manuscripts, you have to have some people in a position to corrupt the manuscripts. Now, I don't think that's ever really possible to do. This is going to be a slightly long answer, but I want to sort of nail that, if you don't mind. What we find with the Gospels is that everyone seems to agree that the four Gospels were written in different towns. So people who are sceptical about the Gospels believe that they were written for different communities, and also the early church traditions and people who believe think they came from different towns. Now, what that means is the day after, say, John's Gospel is written in its town, let's say Ephesus, people in Jerusalem don't know about it. But it also means that it gets handed down in that town, and you can't change all four Gospels early on, because firstly, you can't go to all four towns to sort of get those Gospels, and anyway, you probably didn't know those were going to be the four Gospels to go around changing them. Now, by the middle of the second century, people have got collections of all four Gospels together. So in Syria, the year 170, you've got someone who's made a harmony of the four Gospels into one narrative. Down in Egypt, in Dublin now, but from southern Egypt, around the year 225, you've got a manuscript of all four Gospels. Over in France, in Lyon, Irenaeus, Bishop of Gaul, around the year 185, said having four Gospels is like having four winds. So clearly in the second century, people start having four Gospels. Now note this. You have four Gospels being handed down in some manuscripts at the same time as those four Gospels are also being handed down on their own. Now, there's an overlap between the time when you've got all four Gospels being handed down together and four Gospels being handed separately. That means that if you wanted to change all four, you have to change them in both medium. You see, you have to change both the ones that are bound together and the ones that are separate. Now, the point about this is there really is no time in history when it's particularly believable to think there's anyone been in a position to change all four Gospels. That was the first point. The second point is this. You could make an argument for the credibility of the Gospels without a single copy of them from antiquity. If, imagine, all of the copies of the Gospels had been wiped out from the face of the earth and they arrived on your desk today, could you verify some of the things that they say? And actually, yes, you could do a huge amount to verify them in terms of the knowledge that they have of particular details. Take a story that some people know from Sunday school about a little guy called Zacchaeus who wants to see Jesus. Now, that is a story set in Luke in the town of Jericho. And he climbed up a tree. Some of you know the name of the tree, don't you? What tree was it? A sycamore tree, right? Okay. Now, you ask yourself a simple question. Were there sycamore trees in Jericho? Was it a place where you get a chief tax collector? And was the name Zacchaeus plausible? And for all of those, you find the answer is yes. So how does someone know that? They know that because either they've been there or they've asked someone who's been there. And you could know, you could work that out without a single ancient copy of the text. And it's quite a remarkable thing that you could do that. So I think, you know, I can make an argument for the text, you know, based on the manuscripts, but I could actually say, blow the manuscripts. I think I could do it anyway. But there we are.
Okay, there are other questions.
Yes, sorry, I've got the mic, so it's power, yeah. I mean, the background to this question, to some extent, is Richard Borkum's The Eyewitnesses. And it's also the fact that I'm a Guardian reader, and I'm interested in reporting. And broadly speaking, there's a kind of sociology of reporting that the further you get away from events, the more general they are, the more they pick out important things and so on. But as a sociologist, I'm always surprised where you go through the Gospels and you can read body languages, you can read hesitation, discussions, the kind of irritations that there are going on, the emotional mood of the people involved and so on. Even the place where people are in relation to one another and so on. And I find that very odd because it's so immediate. I mean, we're not really probably going to remember the body language of you two a couple of weeks hence, especially had I not mentioned it. and stuff like that just drops through the reporting system. So I'd especially like to hear from Simon how you reflect on the immediacy of so many of those gospel accounts.
That's an important point that I'm sure you're right, that even though I haven't really ever done any research on this, that memories become more generalised and reports become more generalised as you go on in time. And I suppose, although I haven't sort of thought about the theoretical issue, I think this can certainly be borne out from the different kinds of Gospels that we have. So I mentioned in passing that in the four Gospels in the New Testament, we have dozens and dozens and dozens of place names mentioned, places that Jesus went to and what he did in particular places, in a synagogue in Capernaum or in a house in Nazareth or whatever. It's interesting, when we get to the second century Gospels, like the Gospel of Judas and the Gospel of Thomas, for example, The Gospels of Judas and Thomas both mention two place names each. They've got the same place names as well. One of them is the world, and one of them is, well, actually, in Thomas, Israel, and in the Gospel of Judas, Judea. By this time, they're just producing very, very generalized accounts of Jesus' geographical movements, because there's a sort of losing touch with the nitty-gritty geography of where Jesus actually was. And so, I mean, that geography is just one example of the way in which I think the New Testament Gospels have that sort of verisimilitude, have that authenticity to them. Another one is names. The book that you mentioned makes the striking point that the Gospels reflect almost exactly the relative popularities of certain names. So Pete can perhaps talk more about this. But, for example, when we get to one of the apocryphal Gospels from the second century, we find Jesus talking to someone called Zeno, which is pretty unlikely from our knowledge of first century Palestine.
Yeah, I mean, well, you've read the book. So Richard Borkham lives in Cambridge, in Newnham, was professor of New Testament at St. Andrews, and came up with a remarkable discovery in the last 3 or 4 years, basically saying there are major correlations between the names for individuals you get in the Gospels and names found from the right place in terms of what's on gravestones, bone boxes, ossuaries, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Josephus, the names that they have. 2,600 names you've got for male Jews from Palestine. And you basically find a very close correlation. So the most popular name inside the New Testament is Simon. It's also the most popular name outside. Second most popular name is Joseph. It's also the second most popular outside. Take the top 9 names outside the New Testament. 41% of the names have those. Take the top 9 inside the New Testament. It's 40%. It's pretty close, and it's statistically significant. Now, one of the things that's striking about that is, of course, that that's a pattern that's showing up over 4 different writers writing 5 different books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts. And it's also, I think, a striking thing is that names are about the most forgettable thing out. We all forget names, and in fact, very often you can tell a story about friends and forget the names of the people involved, but you still know the story. I could tell you a story once, and, you know, often you could remember the story, but not the names in it. So the fact that you're getting these sort of names right means you're getting this at an early stage in its transmission. Because as things get, you know, passed on, you're not going to get that sort of name pattern right. And it's simply not credible that someone, you know, writing stories living in Turkey, Greece, or Italy, sort of making them up, would know the patterns of names, statistically, the proportions relative to each other that you'd have in Palestine. And it's probably not credible that even someone in Palestine would have got the proportions right, because you just don't intuitively know the relative proportions that you have of names. So that's just on personal names. But you can do it with place names as well. For instance, all 4 Gospels in an English translation have between 4.6 and 4.9 place names per 1,000 words. You can do it on the English Standard Version. 4.6 to 4.9, that's all 4 of them. It's a very even spread, and it's very, very different from what you find with all the apocryphal Gospels, which are generally under 0.5. Now, that's a proportion, an actual ratio. It's not, you know, so how could you explain that? You know, can you say, well, Luke said to Matthew, or Luke said to Mark, you know, how many words have you got in your Gospel? How many names have you got? I want to try and match, you know, the proportion you've got. You know, they didn't count words back like that. You know, how can you explain that? You can explain it if they're basically reporting the same sort of material consistently, and you know, that would explain an even spread. If you get a long enough narrative and people are just saying what happened, then the names are going to even out. You can't explain it if they're putting in names to make it look authentic. Like, you just couldn't put the same proportion in. It just doesn't make sense. So there are those sort of things that I think, yeah, fit.
So there's a gentleman at the back's been trying to ask a question.
Thanks. So just briefly, I want to press the issue of miracles again in 3 directions. The first thing was what was said earlier about formal logic. and proof. That's wrong. So the point is, here's an example, Hume. I presume you're familiar with the Humean argument against miracles. That argument is essentially a priori. It is a logical, well, mathematical argument, which is formalized in Bayes' theorem later on by, well, Bayes. And it seems to have a good applicability to the real world. So it doesn't follow from simply this thought that something is a formal logical proof that it has an application. Second point, it was said earlier that fair enough, you can explain away all these things individually, but altogether they take some explaining. Well, I think it's one of Richard Dawkins' better arguments, what he calls mountain probable, when he says, well, that's not the case. If I have explained away each thing individually, there just is no, what you might call, big event overall to be explained. So I'd like a comment about that. The third thing is the main point. So it was said earlier that the reason we would be skeptical about miracles in the New Testament and the Old Testament is that we have a mindset that excludes miracles. Okay, but in some of the arguments made earlier in defense of the New Testament, the move was used which said, right, if you're going to postulate this, then you must assume that, and that's implausible. Two examples. The first one was in the case of saying there's just no time in history when they would have had time to edit these texts in the right ways. That is relying on that's implausible. Second example, names. There is no time at which Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John met up and discussed the names that you're going to use. That's implausible. Now, what I want to say is it's not the mindset that excludes miracles. It's simply looking at something, saying, well, it's a miracle. They don't happen. Same move. That's implausible. And that is the reason why the atheists say the miracles are not believable.
You know, philosophically trained and know more about these things than I do. So if I've made a basic blunder when I said there are these two areas where proofs exist and they exist in other areas, I'm very open to learn. That's was said out of genuine conviction, and I'm always open to revise my views. The thing about Bayes and Bayesian probabilities, I understand the issue is that, people differ on this. There are some people who, like Richard Swinburne, you know from Oxford, who's tried to make the argument that the resurrection is probable. It does depend on antecedent beliefs. So if you have a belief that there is no God, it may well be to you that no miracle would ever appear probable. And so, this is an important thing, that what I'm saying when I say, miracles are a ground for belief, is that there are a whole number of things that come together to make Christianity compelling, and there are, if one hasn't got an antecedent commitment to there being no God, then I think you'll find that there are reasons to believe the miracles. If you do absolutely rule out a God, then you're going to, do whatever you need to do to dispute them. And so people take those to their logical conclusion. And if the logical conclusion is going to be a very complex history of early Christianity to explain it all away, then that's what they'll do. So, I mean, I think that'd be the main thing I would say. I think what I would say is the acceptance of the miracles provides a simpler explanation of the documents.
There was someone just in front of this gentleman was also trying to ask a question persistently. So, okay, thank you.
Yes, if I can make a point about time frames. If you look at documents such as, say, Tacitus on Nero or Gregory the Great on St. Benedict, then they're written within the same kind of time frames that the the gospel, but they're overlaid with some elements which are probably fairly heavily mythologized, especially in the case of the Nero one. I've read at least one historian who says that if you take Tacitus's account of Nero, then you're pretty much flying without any kind of support as to what you take and what you leave, because it's all so lunatic. Is there any reason to say that that kind of mythologizing process couldn't equally have happened with the Gospels?
That's a very good analogy, actually, because it is pretty much the same time frame. I think the situation with the Gospels, though, is a bit like the situation, say we have the analogy of Nero and Jesus, which is not one I'm particularly happy with in some ways, but, you know, I think it's more like the case of having Tacitus and Suetonius and who else writes about Nero? And Pliny probably mentions Nero. Who else have we got from around the same time? I can't think of any other second century. Well, say we've got three. You've got three sources from roughly the same time frame talking about Nero. And what we do when we try and work out what happened with Nero was to compare what Suetonius in particular, I suppose, Suetonius and Tacitus being our main sources. You know, we compare them, we evaluate them, we weigh them. And we take into account the prejudices that Tacitus has and his longings for the old ways and the restoration of the Republic. And we take into account Suetonius's, interest in juicy court gossip and so on. So we're striking how, you know, Suetonius and Tacitus, our two main sources, are quite different, aren't they? In some ways, what's interesting about the four Gospels is that they're much closer to each other on Jesus than Suetonius and Tacitus are on Nero. That's probably what I
just come in about the. I mean, I'm not a historian, but the, as I understand the discipline of history and how it perhaps differs from real life, for a moment, if you have something like the Hitler Diaries, and a historian says these are true, you know, genuine, and then is shown to be false, they have a major blot on their career. If, on the other hand, there was something that was true, and they remained very sceptical about it, would that be the same size of blot on their career? I don't think it would. You know, I think that's just the way the discipline works, and it's, gauged towards a more sceptical view. And so that happens in the way we treat all sorts of sources. The way historical sources, everyone sets the discipline, is you have to verify this, weigh this, sift this, and woe betide the historian that believes something they shouldn't have believed. And we just got to recognize that's the way that discipline is set, and there are some good things about that. But then when we come to real life, we actually make decisions on different bases. So you might receive a phone call, relating to a family member from someone whose voice you've never heard of in your life that would make you get in the car and drive right across the country straight away. There are things that, I mean, obviously you could be taken for a ride, but, you know, there are things that we do in real life, assessing everything based on more and less evidence. And one of the things I'd say when we come to evaluating Christianity is, this is a real life decision. It's not the same as some sort of academic discipline decision which we might make, in which things might well be, you know, in an academic discipline might be skewed towards, you know, skepticism because we want to sort of protect ourselves from accusations of credulity.
Yeah, I think Pete's point about the number of the Gospels as well. I mean, Pete and I were both classicists before we sort of went over to the dark side, and in fact, you know, with the four Gospels, we're quite sort of spoiled in terms of. In terms of our knowledge about Jesus. I mean, we say with Socrates, you know, you've got three sources from roughly the same time. With Nero, in the case of Nero, we've got various. But there aren't many historical figures who are the subject of four biographies from around that time. And so I think that's something that's worth bearing in mind.
In fact, there are no non-upper class people who are the objects of sort of contemporary biographies or near contemporary biographies, are there? Is that right? Or certainly pretty weird to have four.
Yeah, probably Aesop.
Contemporary?
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, sorry, not contemporary. Yeah. Yeah.
There are two hands upstairs. Robin, can you sprint up there, please? while he's doing his 10-second job there. Sorry, Dave? Actually, what, Robin has...
Yeah, I think one of the things that we need to consider tonight on a discussion about the trustworthiness of the Bible that hasn't come up yet is the fact that we have to ask the question, what would we expect to find in a book that comes from God, that has the inspiration of God attached to it? And I think one of the things we've ignored tonight is the fact that when we read the Bible, the fact that we're even here tonight having this discussion shows just how influential the Bible has been throughout all these ages in which people have had these kinds of discussions and debates. But one of the things we need to make mention of is the fact that the Bible comes to us from not only 40 different authors of three different continents and three different languages, and there's a unified message that has been maintained through the Gospels and through the Scriptures themselves, but one of the fingerprints of God in the Bible is the fact of prophecy. In the book of Amos, chapter 3, verse 7, it says, "Surely the Lord God does nothing unless he reveals his secrets to his servants, the prophets." In other words, before God does something in our day, he always told about it beforehand in an earlier day. And we're talking hundreds of years prior to events happening. When Jesus Christ was on the earth, he fulfilled over 300 different specific prophecies that were spoken about him, including the fact that he himself and his followers made predictions, and that we have a culmination of so many things that are even coming to head today. And I think one of the things that we have to take into consideration is if the Bible is trustworthy, then it's going to have the evidence of divine authenticity to it. And it does. And archaeologists will use the Bible as a reference point to find places and things in our times, because they're using the Bible as a source for the people and places, as Peter mentioned, the authenticity of names that add up in their times. And so even atheists have given credibility to the Bible when describing events, places, and times. So we have to recognize that the burden of proof is to say, where is the Bible wrong? Where is the Bible actually false? And that's what I would just kind of propose, and maybe you two in the front can comment on that as well. But I believe the Bible has so much authenticity to it by prophecy.
I just wonder what your take is on the synoptic gospel situation. I mean, do we actually have four separate sources, or are they just copies of each other or rearrangements of some other sources?
I think just on that, I think the synoptic gospels, which is Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there is some literary dependence there, as is the general view that Matthew and Luke particularly used Mark. But they clearly have a good deal of a lot of other source material as well. So Matthew and Luke are not quite twice the length of Mark, but have a lot of extra material as well. So I don't think it's quite right to say they're just sort of copying from one another. Matthew and Luke are just a sort of souped up edition of Mark. That would be what I would say on that. I think in terms of the penultimate question. I think it's certainly true that, I mean, for me, the greatest sort of evidence for the truth of Christianity is not in the fact that I can, you know, make this or that academic argument that, you know, such and such a Roman parallel holds true, or this or that Greek or Hebrew parallel holds true, but it's actually the person of Jesus that comes out in the Gospels, that it's when you see who this person is, and how remarkable a person he is, who sort of compels our attention. That, to me, is the evidence for Christianity. And so I would say, if you're a skeptic, I would say, don't sort of read the Gospels and see what it's like compared to Tacitus or Suetonius or this, that, or the other. But I would say, read the Gospels and look to see who you find there, whom you find.
Okay.
Yep. If something in the Bible, Old or New Testament, were to be proved archaeologically to be false, would your faith be damaged?
Yes, I think so. I think the question about, you know, archaeology and method, you know, would have to be addressed. And one of the things that we find is, you know, archaeology, at least if we're dealing with things not including texts, ambiguity there. And so you'd I suppose have to look, what would the falsification be? And I think you, what about another text that sort of stands up and says the opposite of what the Bible says? Well, if I were in that situation, I would still have the question, why would I believe the other text rather than the Bible? If my argument is correct that the Old Testament, for instance, is the equivalent of an ancient monument in many respects, why would, you know, if we dug this one out of the ground, would I, you know, think, well, that one must be right? The other thing, of course, with the Old Testament particularly, is it's not exactly reflective. You know, it doesn't sort of say what good boys the kings were. And what you find is a lot of the ancient texts you find around about, you know, are people blowing their own trumpet and saying how great they are. You know, they tend not to be so reliable. So I tend to think of that as rather, you know, difficult to conceive of. I mean, I think there's so much evidence for Christianity, it's hard to see how it could be falsified. To me, it's a bit like the question is, you know, what evidence would convince you the world wasn't spherical? You know, and you think, well, in principle, I'm open to evidence. But it's just there's so much evidence that convinced me the world is, you know, approximately spherical, I find it hard to imagine that. So that's the way I would view that. It's not that in principle there can't be falsification. Clearly, in 1 Corinthians 15, you know, the resurrection, if that can be proven false, then, you know, the Christian faith, you know, you give up on. Actually, that wouldn't mean, of course, you would give up on believing in God. You know, give up on the Christian faith. So I think there are many, many reasons to believe, and therefore it would take a long, you know, a number of things to unravel it all.
Simon, do you want to add that? No, just it's one of those sort of impossible theoretical questions, isn't it? Yeah, what would you do if you discovered you were adopted? Or, I don't know.